Hello and welcome to this week's Football Fans Podcast, the shootout where we get a former player on to talk a little bit about their career. We go a little bit more in depth and find out what they're up to. And this week on the pod, we have the former Notts County, Birmingham, Derby, Sheffield Wednesday and Jamaican international Michael Johnson. How are you doing, sir?
I'm excellent. Excellent, Jordan. Yourself?
I'm good, my friend. I'm very, very good. I'm very good. I didn't mention there that you were also the head coach of Guyana. Talk to me about that. How'd that come about and how much are you enjoying it?
Well, I'm enjoying it extremely well. It's a great honour to manage a country, to lead a country into a major tournament like the Gold Cup. We're not there yet. We are one step away. Mm-hmm. But it's an accolade that I'm not taking lightly. There's a lot of people's hopes and dreams are waiting on March the 23rd.
I read a quote, I was doing some notes for this, and Carlos Queiroz, he said it's essential to adapt to a nation's football rather than try to change it. And I'm just wondering, how hard have you, if indeed you find it hard at all, find it to adapt to Guyanese footballing culture, or are you taking a completely different approach about how you try and bring success to that nation?
No, he's spot on. The last few weeks I've been down in Guyana, and one of the main things I've been down there for is to understand the culture, understand what it means, and understand the players that I'm working with from the local players. So you have to try and connect. If you try and go to a foreign country and you don't understand the culture, then it's a real difficult task. So the last couple of weeks have really helped me understand better. And that will allow me to connect better with not only the players, but also the fans.
Is it true you guys play at a cricket ground?
Well, the next game, hopefully, the 23rd, will be at the National Stadium, which is the cricket ground. Currently, we're playing at a place called the Leonora Stadium,
yeah,
which is on the outskirts of town, which is across a floating bridge, which has its difficulties in getting fans to it. But this is the reason why we're asking for the cricket ground, which has been historically one that's been used for the bigger games. And yes, potentially we could be playing at the cricket stadium.
And is that part of the kind of the difficulties that you're having to get used to in, you know, managing a nation that's not a superpower football nation? Or do you just kind of get on with it and just crack on?
No, I think you get on with it because it's a great opportunity. But I think you have to understand culturally, as we've spoken about, that you're not going to get the flat pitches, you're not going to get the terrific stadiums you've got in England. What you might have to do is be a little bit more flexible in the way you utilise the resources of the country. What has happened since I've been there, and it's a great job done by the technical director, Ian Greenwood, is that there's now a training centre, which allows for training to be administered at any time of day. It's a 4G pitch, which has been put in by FIFA, which is now owned by the Federation, which allows us to have our own training camp. Previous to that, we were trying to get on a pitch, and if there was the weather was bad or the pitch was being used, we couldn't train. Mm-hmm. So when you're talking about understanding the cultural aspect, I couldn't go down there and say we're training at this time and this pitch because you might not have the facilities to do that. Mm. So it's a waste of time getting flustered with. It's a waste of time getting irritable. You just got to get on with what's happening.
And what's it like managing a nation that's at the lower end of the kind of FIFA ranking list? And do you feel that FIFA do enough to support some of the smaller footballing nations?
It's a really good question. And first of all, it's an absolute real privilege to be a manager of a country, mm-hmm, and to lead a country into the Gold Cup. From the FIFA aspect, I think we could do more. One is definitely about recruitment, because you need your best players to even stand a chance of climbing the FIFA rankings. Mm-hmm. But also, added to that, is your players, because you're a lesser country, you're going to be taking majority of your players from the lower leagues. So majority of my players come from League 1, League 2, non-league. But then the FIFA window continues. So you're constantly going up against managers because they want their better players for their fixture.
I see.
And I want the players for the international window. But it's only the Premier League and Championship.
Yeah, yeah.
So what? So So what I would suggest is, why don't you give grassroots a real leg up by saying the whole league shuts down, which would allow football fans just to go and really, you know, support and get behind their local grassroots teams.
No, I hear you. That's not a bad idea. I first met you, Michael, because you've done a lot of work, and I imagine still do some work with BCOMS, with the Black Collective of Media and Sports that Leon Mann started up and still heads up. And you've been a massive advocate for more opportunities for Black and ethnic minorities to have more opportunities in the management side of the game as well. Your route, when you finished playing, you went into the more administrative side of the game with your role at Derby. Was that because of the lack of opportunities in management just weren't coming your way?
I'd say it's a mixture of both. I would say one was a frustration. One was that I was going to just keep getting myself educated and keep moving up the educational ladder. And another one was because the opportunity opened up, and Derby, Mel Morris in particular, thought that I was the best person for the role. Mm-hmm. So he offered me the role.
What was the role, Michael? Just for listeners.
I've got an ambassadorial role.
Okay.
At the club, and it's a full-time position, which is really good.
Mm-hmm. And also, do you, one question I want to ask you as well? Do you feel, I want to kind of just move into football now and on the pitch. Do you think it's time that we had a Black Players and Managers Union? There's been so much nonsense, in particular in the last 18 months. Do you feel it's time that Black players and Black managers have their own representation? Or does that kind of defeat the overall point of trying to be more inclusive and bring us closer together?
Well, you know, I remember there was discussions around this probably 5 years ago. And it was something that the game didn't want to happen. And it was, you know, let's join up. Our thought process, let's try and work a way out, let's try and make sure, you know, there's a lot more visibility, there's a lot more managers getting positions. What I would say is that I think that has to be considered, because here we are 5 years later, here we are 20, maybe 30, 40 years later after the likes of Cyril Regis, Luther Blissett, Bill Anderson, and we're still having these discussions, not just about what's happening on the terraces, but also what's happening fundamentally in the leadership positions. As with women, as with ethnicity, there's a severe lack of leadership from people who are ethnicity and of gender. So just like, you know, there's a woman's body what's come together, then I think there should be some serious thought process about, is there a place in the game for an ethnic no organisation to come together so it can really start to understand and support managers, coaches and indeed players of all races.
I hear you. And in your opinion, Michael, why has overt racism, you know, popped his head up again? We've seen, you know, a handful of incidents this year, season alone. I'm not one of these people that, you know, is of the mindset that, you know, we solved this problem. Why has it come back? It was always there. But why do you think the overt racism has been so prevalent this season?
I think obviously Brexit's got a large part to do with it. And I think what it's done, and I wouldn't say that all Brexit voters, regardless whether you voted in or out, but majority obviously voted out, are racist. But what it's done, it's give certain people's a voice where people start saying, oh yeah, that's the reason why they voted out. And there's numerous reasons as to why. But those voices feel empowered now to start rising their head. And unfortunately, the game's governance of these issues, the punishment of these issues, is not severe enough to detract people away from racist taunts, whatever you want to call it at stadium. The recent racism that we've seen, which has really imploded on the game.
we discussed this briefly on our show last week, Michael. We had Darren Lewis from The Mirror on, and I asked him, you know, what he thinks needs to be done. And I posed the question, are we at the point now where fans need to start policing racist fans? And the consensus on the panel was no. And I tend to agree with that as well. I don't think it should be on the fans, but I was trying to think of solutions as to what we can do now. And he says that, Darren was saying that the authorities need to have a zero tolerance policy, but he also followed up by saying, but they won't, because it's just too much hassle, it's too much aggravation for them. Do you tend to agree, or do you have any other solutions as to what needs to be done now to make sure that if you come into a football stadium and if you are seen and caught chanting racist abuse at anybody in the stadium, there are consequences?
Well, I think first of all, I think the government now need to make this a actual criminal offence. So there's a criminal record for this. I also think the person needs to be shamed, you know, put out there so people know who exactly this is.
Somebody mentioned that on the show last week, actually. Yeah, name and shame culture.
Yeah, name and shame policy. If you're brave enough to say that, then we'll let everybody hear what you've had to say and see who said it. I'm sure certain organisations where you work, I'm sure your family and your children were very proud of whoever said that. So that might be something. I struggle to understand how a club should be penalised for it, whether it's points or... I'm not a big fan of that one, if I'm honest. But I also think the game now needs to show zero tolerance. I even thought about whether clubs should be playing games behind closed doors, or whether clubs should be... But why should a club, and why should the rest of the fans suffer for the ignorance of one or two mindless individuals? So I think we've really got to tackle the individual themselves and naming and shaming them, give them a criminal record, and ban them for life from football.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on now. You were the captain of Derby for a period there, Michael. What for you is the most important trait of being a captain in 2019, especially in comparison to when you played?
I think nowadays it's leadership. I think, you know, when you look at the game now and the amount of people and the amount of countries, the amount of different people from all over the world, you know, it's a real skill to be able to blend that in the changing rooms, to make people feel welcome, to make people feel like they've got a voice. And ultimately, that will result itself in a performance. So I think right now, I think if I was a captain of a dressing room now in 2019, my real focus would be how could I use certain soft skills, people skills, to make people feel comfortable, wanted, valued, and heard.
I hear you. At what point, Michael, did you start thinking about life beyond the game? Was you thinking very early on about what you were going to be doing when you stopped playing football, or did it hit you in the last year of your playing career?
Yeah, it hit me basically in the last year, because you always think there's enough in the body, there's enough in the tank to go again. Even though I knew very early on, you know, 32, 33, that my legs were going. But I managed to get a good few years out of it. But yeah, probably in my last year, I was thinking, you know what, I'm struggling to recover as quickly as I used to. I'm struggling to keep pace up with some of the runs that we used to do. And it started to really, you know, show itself upon me that, you know what, you need to start thinking, what's next?
You had that Gary Neville moment.
Yeah, you do. I always remember there was a player that went past me, and 9 times out of 10, this player should never have gone past me. And that's when the moment I thought,
yeah,
okay,
I'm done.
I'm done.
It's time to stop it now. Michael, who was the best player you played with and against?
The best player I played with was undoubtedly a player called Christophe Dugarry.
Okay.
Who played for France in the 98 World Cup. You know, he came to Birmingham City, and you might as well say single-handedly kept us up. He was unbelievable for us.
What was it about him that was so good?
Just the way he dealt with the ball. He was so comfortable. He was relaxed. He could go left and right. He could shoot left and right. He had a burst of speed. And he was that good that I remember Steve Bruce, our manager, used to say, when you would get the ball, your first thought is where's Christophe?
Was he the Berbatov before Berbatov?
He was the Berbatov before Berbatov. I'm sure Berbatov got it from Christophe, if I'm honest.
and the best player you played against?
I'd say the Brazilian Ronaldo, but also the Ronaldo himself.
Yeah.
And do you know what? I cannot ignore Thierry Henry. They're probably the three best players where, you know, I'm still getting nightmares from them.
So we know that their finishing ability, their skill level, and their pace, in particular, the R9 Ronaldo and Henri. But what else was it about all three of those, or one of those three players, that really made them so good and was so difficult to mark?
Well, if I talk about Thierry Henry, it's just the aura of him that, like, if he makes a run at that particular time and that particular era, Arsenal players, the ball was delivered every time he made the run. There was no energy expanded from Thierry Henry. When he made the run, it was like clockwork. They knew where to put the ball.
Mm.
And when you had players of the likes of Bergkamp, Wiltord, Pires, you know, Vieira, you had players that literally could just, you know, put the ball on a 10-pence piece. Mm-hmm. It was a fantastic team. We got beat 4-0. But one of those 4-0s where you come off and you're quite happy that
you take that.
Yeah, you take that.
You played in the 3-2 win I was reading over Nigeria that featured Kanu. He was in that Nigerian side.
Yeah.
What was your best memory playing for your country, though?
There was a qualification for the Gold Cup. We qualified to play for the Gold Cup, mm-hmm. which I'm trying to do now with Guyana.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an amazing achievement to go and play on a stage that is similar to the Euros. It was just fantastic to represent your country, your parents' place of birth, in a major tournament against some of the best players in the world.
I hear you. And you played for the Jamaica, as you mentioned, 13 times, but does it at all irk you that players who could play for Jamaica choose England, or do you completely understand the kind of commercial and the profile benefits that come with playing for a nation like England?
Yeah, I completely understand. Obviously, the trappings that come with it, and you rightly said, commercially, the profile, and just general resources is better. But what I would say is that there's a lot of youngsters who have made one or two appearances for England at the younger ages, who potentially, if they know about it, and I'm facing this with Guyana now, is that they could actually transfer their association back to their parents' place of birth or grandparents' place of birth, okay. if they do not go on to make the appearances that they wished.
Can you ever see Jamaica making another World Cup anytime soon?
They've got a strong team. I don't really see that in a foreseeable future, and that's not me being negative. It's just me being real with what I hear and see going on.
I hear you. And just finally, Michael, I asked all my guests on this show, ex-players, this question. If there's one thing you could change to improve the game, one thing, what would be the one thing that you would implement or take away?
That's a really good question. If there was one thing that I could do to make the game better, I think it would be the governance for academies. I've got a big gripe about the age group that youngsters are now starting. Agents are getting hold of young players. Ideally, I think youngsters should be just free to go and play football to like the 14 years old. You know, let's allow them to be kids, play with the school, play with their friends. And then if there was an overall, you know, FA governance that said nobody could purchase kids, not purchase, that's a wrong word, but
I know what you mean, yeah.
Acquire kids at 14 years old. And I think, you know, kids can develop with freedom and just allow kids to be kids. What I see now is a lot of 8-9-year-olds who cannot play with school, cannot play with the friends, and then maybe 12-13 they get kicked out anyway, which is such a shame.
No, I hear you. Listen, Michael, all the best with qualifications during the process of the World of the Gold Cup. And thanks for coming on the pod. Cheers, man.
Pleasure. Cheers, Jordan.
Cheers, Michael. Right. Cheers.